Today on Maine Calling, bringing back the American chestnut tree. The American chestnut tree used to dominate the eastern forests, including those in Maine. These were huge, majestic trees that supplied strong wood for building cabins and furniture, and their chestnuts were food for all sorts of wildlife and people. I'm Cindy Hahn. On this Arbor Day, we learn the story of how this iconic American tree was decimated by a harmful fungus, which by 1950 had killed billions of trees. We'll hear about promising efforts to bring American chestnuts back from the brink. Maine is key to these efforts. It has more mature, flowering wild American chestnuts than any other state. We'll also discuss how other valuable Maine trees can be protected from threats that include insects, diseases, and humans. The importance of protecting trees. Maine Calling is coming right up.
Maine Calling On Demand is made possible in part by Maine Farmland Trust, working with farmers to grow the future of farming and food in Maine. Learn how you can get involved at mainefarmlandtrust.org/learn. And by Welch & Forbes, working with clients to manage the full range of events that come with building wealth, from investments to trustee services. More at welchforbes.com.
This is Maine Calling. I'm Cindy Hahn. Decades ago, the forests in our part of the country used to look different. Giant American chestnut trees dominated the landscape, but the vast majority of them were decimated by blight. Today, marking Arbor Day, we'll learn how the American chestnut is being brought back to life and how Maine is playing an important role in those efforts. And we'll hear about other trees that face threats and how to protect them. Joining me, Eva Butler. She's an ecologist, a community organizer, and outreach coordinator, and vice president for the Maine chapter of the American Chestnut Foundation. Sarah Fern Fitzsimmons is forest ecologist and chief conservation officer with the American Chestnut Foundation at Penn State University. And Patty Cormier is director of the Maine Forest Service with the Maine Department of Agriculture, Conservation, and Forestry. We invite you to join the conversation. Do you want to know how to identify a wild chestnut tree? Are there other species of trees that you're worried about? Email talk@mainepublic.org or post a comment on Facebook or Instagram or give us a call, 1-800-399-3566. Sarah, I'm going to start with you. The American chestnut tree has a pretty dramatic story. So can you first set the stage and tell us about when this tree was thriving, how common it was, and where they were found?
Yeah, sure thing. Thanks so much for having this topic on your show. The American chestnut used to be about 4 billion trees across the eastern United States, and Maine really was the northern terminal of its range. It can go all the way up into central Maine. And it was one of the largest trees in the eastern U.S., on average between 5 and 6 feet in diameter at breast height. But there are some trees that reached even upwards of 15 feet in diameter. So they could grow really large, especially in the southern Appalachians. And people would refer to it as this cradle-to-grave tree because it could be used for so many different uses, cribs, coffins, and everything in between. It just had this great versatility. People may be familiar with eating the chestnuts too, chestnuts roasting on an open fire and all that. So there's lots of wood utility, lots of eating, lots of habitat. The leaves provide a lot of food for insects and other wildlife. Unfortunately, due to nursery trade throughout the mid to late 1800s, a non-native pathogen was actually two of them were brought into the U.S., two fungal-like organisms, but the primary one being chestnut blight. The chestnut blight fungus was brought in the late 1800s on Japanese chestnuts that were brought over for people to put in their yards. The Japanese chestnut is actually a really beautiful tree, but it had this fungus to which the American chestnut has no resistance. And that fungus took off basically from around the New York City area, the port areas of New York, Philadelphia, Newark. The fungus spread very quickly from about the late 1800s. And by 1950, all 4 billion of those original trees had been impacted and had gotten the blight. died back. And today we have about 400 million trees, all of which are, or most of which are less than an inch in diameter. They're these little sprouts that are growing in the understory. They're no longer those 5-6 foot diameter giants that they used to be. And we refer to them as functionally extinct because they're there. They're not threatened. They're not endangered. There's millions of them, but they're just hanging out, not performing their ecosystem functions like they used to.
And I understand that the blight will still get them, right? So even though they're there, they're still not going to thrive. Is that how it works?
That's correct. Yeah. So the blight, the fungus gets into the tree dies back. And like a lot of hardwood, other hardwood species, they can resprout. So they sprout from the base and create these new trees, get infected usually 5 to 10 years after they grow up. Get infected, die back, resprout. So they're sort of in this Sisyphean cycle of die back and resprout over and over again.
Oh, boy. So, Eva, did this exact pattern happen in Maine the same way? Were they abundant in Maine and then completely died off? Or do we have American chestnuts left in Maine forests?
Yeah, that's a good question. I think it's one of, part of the exciting news about chestnuts in Maine is that we actually have more living big trees in Maine than any other state. And I'm not certain of this, but I'm an ecologist, so I have to imagine that, you know, this was the northern extent of their range. And so they probably weren't as dense, you know, didn't grow as densely as they did down south. So if one got blight, it wasn't super easy to transfer it to its neighbor. So as a result, we have a lot of the genetics of chestnuts are still alive and well in Maine. They just will ultimately, mostly probably all, succumb to it. So I think the exciting part for Maine is that we have this opportunity, first of all, just to conserve those genes and make sure the trees continue to survive while we await a more resistant chestnut tree but there's a responsibility in that too, that, you know, we have this time period while we're all working toward some kind of resistance that we can put into the forest. And so for now, we need to figure out where are those trees, gather nuts from those trees, plant those nuts, and sort of keep a continuous cycle of those trees alive and well so that they're there when it comes time to pollinate them with resistant genes or add resistant trees into the forest.
So I've read that Maine has the most wild mature flowering chestnuts in more than any other state. What is that? Is that describing the original kind of American chestnut, or what? Why do we have the most, and what is it that we have the most of?
Yeah, I think we have the, because I think we're probably Sarah is from in the South, you would see lots of bushy chestnuts sprouting from root sprouts, but probably not a lot of trees standing tall and creating nuts. And we are still finding those trees in Maine, I think is a good answer to your question. We know where many of them are because for the last, well, almost 30 years, there have been volunteers in Maine out there looking for these remnant populations that that they could gather nuts from. But every time we do a show like the Freiburg Fair and the public sort of walks in to talk with us, they go, oh, you know, we have one, you know, in our woods. And so we note that, and we have just started a group within our chapter, the main chapter of the Chestnut Foundation, called the Bushwhackers Brigade. And we're training them how to go find a tree in the forest, note its location, put that into our database that's called Dentatabase, so that we've secured its location for posterity. And, you know, in a few years, bushwhackers can go back out and find those trees and record what condition they're in. So we really expect in the next few years, once we get all of that data input and take the time to go find them, that we'll have more sources of wild nuts and hopefully even more genetics that we can use to diversify the pot that we'll use for breeding.
I want to spend some more time on how you're trying to bring them back. And Sarah, I'll go to you. But I wanted to turn to Patty, because Patty, I know You've talked before on Maine Calling about the Big Tree Program, and as Sarah described, these American chestnuts were some of the giants. I guess they called them like the redwoods of the East, right? If you've seen pictures, people are just standing next to the trunk and they look tiny. So the Maine Forest Service does this, keeps track of the biggest trees in Maine, and it sounds like there was a time when American chestnuts would be the ones on the list. Are there big ones still in Maine today? And if so, how do they rank?
Yeah, so interestingly, first of all, happy National Arbor Day to everybody.
Yeah.
When chestnuts, when they were thriving, they were 25% of the Maine forest. So one in every four trees was a chestnut tree. Very iconic to our ecology, to our wildlife, very important, kind of the perfect tree, long, straight grain, beautiful color wood. And just so important to Maine. But to answer your question, yeah, since the 60s, the Maine Forest Service has kept a list of the biggest trees that are nominated. Doesn't mean we see everything that's out there. And there's been a few on the list, one in Hebron. There was one in Lovell that was over 115 feet tall, and that was discovered by someone. It was in an abandoned field. It was very tall because it had been fighting, competition with the white pines. And the message there is for everybody to be on the lookout and report it. Currently, it's the tallest or the biggest tree. Chestnut is in Reed Field, 82 feet tall, I believe, 69 inches in circumference. And the sad progression of this is it keeps changing, right? Because we keep losing these trees. And as Eva said, it's really about people looking and being aware and monitoring and kind of, citizen science of chestnuts.
Well, how did those dodge the blight for long enough to grow that tall? Patty, go. Do you
That's a good
know?
question, and I'm gonna punt that to Sarah or Eva.
Sure, Sarah, any explanation for that?
Yeah, I think Eva kind of hinted at it a little bit in that the density of American chestnut in Maine isn't quite as high as it is in some locations. While it might have been one in every four, in some areas in our area where I am, I'm in central PA and farther south. I mean, it could have been upwards of 50% of the forest in some of these locations. But the blight is a fungus, and it likes it where it's warm and wet. And so, up in Maine, especially going up farther north, where you find these remnant, we call them escapes. They have escaped becoming infected. I want to make it clear that most of these, well, I would say all, none of these are resistant. They have just escaped infection, because the blight doesn't love it up there, which is a kind of good thing. So you can find these really beautiful large trees. I love Maine. I'm so happy to be a part of that. You guys have let me in on this because I have spent about 15 summers, 2 weeks every summer, doing field work in Atkinson, Maine, on a site, a 15-acre site of American chestnut, of naturally regenerating trees. And to build on, what Eva talked about, how important the trees of Maine are, that site and others where there is recruitment of American chestnuts in the understory, they are vital to us understanding reintroduction and restoration protocols of how many nuts do you need a tree to make to overcome predation that can make babies so that they can grow up and be trees and then make babies too. So it's that kind of stuff that, not just the capturing of the genetics, but the capturing of these population dynamics that Maine is playing such a vital role in to understanding how we can restore these trees back into the forest.
Can you take us through more step by step what the American Chestnut Foundation is actually doing to restore the trees? Because you've all hinted at it quite a bit, but kind of walk us through that.
So we work with a lot of different partners to try and implement various technologies. Pretty much what we've found. So the American Chestnut Foundation has been in existence for 40 years. We started with work that was started back in the 1920s with the USDA and other state ag organizations that were trying to restore the American chestnut. So there's lots of breeding work, hybridization work that's been done to try and bring resistance in from Asiatic species like the Chinese or Japanese chestnut. So we use resistance mechanism through traditional breeding like that. We're working with biotech approaches.
Oops, I think we lost your audio, Sarah. So we'll come back to you to find more about breeding. But let's go ahead to a caller right now. And let's see, Ryan. Hi, Ryan calling from Freeport. What did you want to know?
So I hope this isn't too far off topic, but I live in Freeport, and there's quite a few what I believe are horse chestnuts in the downtown area. I actually have one at my house, and I was just curious about if there's any relationship, if they're something from away, or if they're actually a native tree, and if they're affected by that fungus as well, or, you know, and whether or not there's something that I should be, you know, transplanting or whatever around, or if they're not something that's good for the area.
Sure, good question, Ryan. I think others want to know that as well. And Eva, is a horse chestnut the same thing? Are we talking about the same kind of tree?
No, it is not the same tree. And it is often the case that when someone will claim they have a chestnut and they've had it for a long time, our first effort is to make sure that people can differentiate between those two, because it's an easy mistake to make. But the horse chestnut, I believe, is not native. It's not native to Maine. It doesn't have like the food value of a chestnut. I don't know if people I think are discouraged from eating horse chestnuts. Is that right, Patty?
Yeah. Well, horse chestnut, no, it used to, they used to be used, the nut themselves, the Native Americans would crush them and throw them in the water and would kind of stun the fish, poison the fish a little bit. So a little ancient form of fishing. So it's not recommended to eat those.
So probably not stun. How would that stun the fish? Is it toxins?
Yeah. Yeah. Huh. And I've just read that in folklore books and have never experienced it myself. But I just wanted to add that it's what we call naturalized in Maine. It's not native, but it's naturalized. And the biggest one, just looking at the big tree list again, is in Bath, 158 inches in circumference and a height of 68 feet.
Okay. And actually, while you're talking about the actual chestnuts the American chestnut as a food source, can you talk a little bit about that and the importance of that to wildlife, Patty?
Yeah, we kind of call, chestnut and the nuts kind of indicator species of indicating health of the ecology, and certainly was a big food source for deer and mammals in the forest. And as you can imagine, to lose 25% of the composition in its day was quite a hit to the ecology. And it truly was a game changer for Maine when we started losing all the chestnut.
All right. Well, thank you, Ryan, for the question about horse chestnuts. Eva, go ahead.
Yeah. Speaking of eating things and things you shouldn't eat, I just was walking through Ocean State job lot yesterday afternoon, and I saw bags of chestnuts for sale. And my heart kind of dropped, because I thought, oh, people out there are going to buy these things and they're going to probably discover, for the most part, they don't want to buy them another time. And the belief that, oh, yeah, I don't really like chestnuts. The fact is that so few people have ever eaten an American chestnut. The ones that are sold here are not American chestnuts for sure. A lot of them are imported. I find they're not very tasty. But when I joined the American Chestnut Foundation about 2.5 years ago, one of the first things that was offered to me was a taste of American chestnuts that had just been roasted over our chapter founder, Eric Evans, is quite good at roasting them. And they're small. They're a lot of bother to trouble with, but they're delicious. They're sweet. And there's an ice cream made by an ice cream manufacturer down toward Biddeford Way. And there's nothing like chestnut ice cream made from American chestnuts. And every time I'm lucky enough to get some, I'm so grateful that Tom Clack, the professor down in at the University of New England, has a lot of students that work on the research on American chestnuts. And they are the ones picking through and getting the chestnut meats out and delivering them to the ice cream maker. It's a lot of work, but it's such a great thing, whether you're husking chestnuts or counting them and bagging them and storing them, or making ice cream or making cookies. It's such a great thing to bring people together around a thing that many people can't say they've ever had. And very likely, you know, they're looking at their grandparents or great-grandparents as the last ones who got to enjoy something that was quintessentially American for so many generations.
Oh, I want to try that ice cream. We need to go to break, but I actually want to sneak in a quick question with Sarah about the chestnuts. I read that the trains used to just be loaded with chestnuts going to deliver them, people, especially at holiday time, back when the American chestnut trees were prevalent.
That's true, especially in the mountains where the American chestnuts were especially prevalent. People of those areas would gather them. That was a primary driver of those local economies, get them onto trains that would then be shipped primarily to urban centers and then sold there.
That's so amazing. Well, we do need to take a quick break. We're talking about efforts to bring back the American chestnut tree and also how to protect Maine trees from threats. Give us a call, 1-800-399-3566. This is Maine Calling. We'll be right back. Welcome back. This is Maine Calling. I'm Cindy Hahn. For Arbor Day, we're talking about restoration of the American chestnut tree, which was on the brink of extinction, and what we can do to protect chestnuts and other trees in Maine. With me are Patty Cormier, State Forester with the Department of Agriculture, Conservation, and Forestry. Eva Butler is an ecologist and outreach coordinator for the Maine chapter of the American Chestnut Foundation. And also with the American Chestnut Foundation is Sarah Fern Fitzsimmons, Chief Conservation Officer, and she's located at Penn State University. Share your comments and questions. Are you wondering how you can help save American chestnuts or other trees in Maine? Email us at talk@mainepublic.org, comment on Facebook or Instagram, or call 1-800-399-3566. I'm going to read a question. This is an email from JJ saying, I know Maine is hosting some interesting chestnut restoration research that uses genetic engineering to protect the trees from blight. What are your thoughts about that work, and is the Chestnut Foundation involved in it? And I know the answer is yes. You all already talked a little bit about that. Sarah, can you explain more sort of, you know, talk us through the steps of how you are using genetics to make these chestnut trees more resistant to blight?
Yeah, sure. So specifically through genetic engineering and modification, we work with other partners to right now the biggest methodology is to use a gene from wheat called OXO or oxalate oxidase. And that gene detoxifies a chemical that the fungus uses to kill the American chestnut tree. So it's a pretty cool tool. We work with other labs to create these transgenic trees. And then there's a researcher, primarily Tom Clack, whom Eva mentioned earlier. He works at the University of New England. He has done some really tremendous work to advance what we call speed breeding, where you get these trees to produce pollen or nuts faster so that we can evaluate them and figure out if they have the resistance that we need and are going to be able to work out into the forest. So I think for your listeners, it's really important to know that, you know, genetic modification is kind of a hot button topic. And for the moment, these trees are highly regulated and permitted. You can only use them and study them in very limited research processes. So all of this research is being done under very heavily regulated and permitted locations. But we see that there's going to be a lot of utility using this methodology to help restore the American chestnut.
I'm going to go back to something you explained earlier, too. I think this is one of the basic things you do, right, is to crossbreed the American chestnut with a species that is more resistant to blight, like you said, the Chinese chestnut, right? And so what percentage do they need to resist blight to be mixed with another species? And also, does that mean for the American chestnut to survive, they almost always have to be not really 100%? They have to have something else mixed in.
Pretty much that you we do not at this point know of any way to take just a straight line wild American chestnut tree and make it resistant without mixing something else in. So we're going to have either genetics through traditional breeding or through cisgenics or transgenics bring in genes from Japanese or Chinese chestnuts, and likely also bring in transgenes from, like I said, this wheat gene or barley gene or other avenues as well.
I see. All right, let's go to a question from Peter calling in from Buxton. Go ahead, Peter.
Yes, indeed. My neighbor has a Chinese chestnut that's doing quite well on the roughly on the corner of Route 202 and the Salmon Falls River. There are two American chestnuts now growing in my yard. I got some seeds from Glenn Ray of the American Chestnut Foundation, Maine. And put them in the yard and got a couple of takers, and they're doing pretty well for a 10-year-old tree. And I'm hoping they will escape notice from some of the blight that's around because I do know it's in the nearby forest at the they call it the Pleasant Point Park. I've marked quite a few of them, and I know of one that's at least 18 years old. So there are relic trees around, and it's kind of exciting to see them and experience, you know, I haven't seen them fruit at all, but it's good to see them around. I just want to leave it at that.
That's nice to hear. Thanks for calling, Peter. And Eva, how does it work if someone wants to, go to your chapter and say, I would like to grow a seedling in my yard? What do they do, and then what's the follow-up to that?
I think the first thing I'd suggest is that they visit the website that is really where we disseminate information about how to, where to, when to. That's the if they just Google American Chestnut, they're likely to hit it. But it's TACF or the American Chestnut Foundation.org. And the main website has a website, a sub-site for each of the chapters. So if they live in Maine and they want to know what's going on in Maine, they can go to our main chapter web pages. But a lot of resources are posted on the main website. Wonderful ways, how to grow a chestnut if you get a nut, how to report a chestnut tree if you think you have one. They can always reach out, to the chapter through email. We typically sell seedlings and nuts each year. Our members, we really encourage people to join because if you're on our member list, you get first call. They sell out very quickly at most of the venues that sell them for us. But you can definitely plant nuts outside. You can plant seedlings outside by after the last frost, so around mid-May through the month of June. It's not that hard to grow them. Just bear in mind that all of those little animals that evolved or co-evolved with chestnuts here, they some part of their institutional memory of squirreldom and blue jaydom, they still recognize the fruits of chestnut trees just great 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 grandparents did. So you have to protect them from those animals when you plant them. But as your caller was saying from Buxton, it's not even unusual to have a plant a tree and have it live 10, 15, 20 and more years. It's really a matter of luck. But my understanding is that when the trees are young, their bark is smooth, more like a beech tree, really. It's just when they get to a certain age and they start to develop their more adult type of bark, the bark splits and creates fissures, and those are the entry points for the fungus. But if there's not a lot of blight around, your chances of getting nuts for many years is very good. You just have to bear in mind that none of the trees sold now by anyone that are pure American have resistance to the blight. They will succumb at some point. And just because yours is doing great, we'd love to think, oh, maybe the resistant genes are in mine, right? Maybe I've cracked the nut, cracked the code, but that's unlikely. So you go into it knowing that longevity is not to be had. But I think the joyful part of this mission for me is that it's going to take all of us working together to get to a point where this tree comes back, and the blue jays and the squirrels and, you know, all of the wildlife that benefited from it and moved it around the landscape and replanted it. They're still out there waiting for this to happen. And it, you know, there's so many trees, and I'm sure Patty, you know, Patty has seen her share of exotic insects and pathogens that have come from other places are taking down many of our native trees. And that is, I see no sign of that stopping. Like, we are so committed to a global economy where we get to move things from one place to another. And it's not just the United States. You know, I hear from people in other countries that we've brought them invasive plants and invasive insects. We're just shipping them to one another, and they're having the same kind of impacts in their countries. So it's going to take a real commitment to slow down the rate of this problem. But in the meantime, I think what the American Chestnut Foundation and all of its volunteers and scientists were dedicated to sort of paving the way to show, if you put enough effort in, can you get to a point where you bring it back? This is a test case, I think, really, for whether, you know, all the king's horses and all the king's men can put Humpty Dumpty back together again.
Humpty Dumpty as a tree. Patty, pick up on what Eva just said. What can we learn from the story of the American chestnut that applies to other trees and how to protect our forests in Maine?
Yeah, my little piece of my wisdom, you should always take time to reflect on the good and the bad experiences and what we can learn from them. And with the chestnut and the past experiences, you know, we can certainly support policies and regulations that limit the introduction of threats through live plant material and other vectors, encourage harvest practices that balance the maintenance of genetic diversity within with mitigation of impacts, and support host resistance and tolerance through survey for lingering trees in the aftermath of damaged trees by invasive species. Of course, we're seeing that with ash and beech scale disease, and support regional tree breeding programs, encourage and support an integrated response to management, including supportive research and biological control. And, you know, our trees in Maine, we are on the brink, and Eva alluded to it, that back when this disease, this fungus was invading, it was a slower pace. Right now, we're with the climate conditions we're facing right now, it's a faster pace. So we're seeing infestations, beech leaf disease that a few years ago we didn't know was here, and now there's thousands of acres. So it's just this explosive rate which we're seeing these issues. And it's about, again, I'm gonna say it's about people being aware and trying to be a part of the solution, right? And keeping invasives at bay.
Okay, thank you. Let's go now to the phones. Larry is calling from Bangor. Hi, Larry, go ahead.
Ni hao. I was given three, I was given three of the trees about 15 years ago. They are now 3 feet in diameter. My point being, they grow very fast. And my second question is, there ever been a report of a beech and chestnut hybrid? I have a tree I can't quite identify. I know the bark of the two of them look the same when they're young, as you pointed out. But I was taught my dendrology by Ken Hendren, an old Indian forester, and he's since passed. But I don't recognize it as either a beech or a chestnut. And I want to thank the forester, I can't remember her name, who gave me the trees.
Well, thanks for calling, Larry. Let's take two parts of that question. Patty, what about the hybrid? Is there such a thing?
So I have not seen such a thing, but I just wanted to offer up to Larry that we have a core of foresters in the Forest Service and a community forestry program that they will come out to and look at it and try to determine what that is for you. And you can contact them through our website, maineforestservice.org. But I haven't seen that before.
That's a good tip. Thank you. And then as far as how fast they grow, what Larry described, Sarah, is that typical?
They do grow fast. I don't know about 3 feet in what, 15 years? I wonder if that might be circumference. But we can have upwards of an inch to an inch and a half per year in growth in terms of diameter growth. So it can grow quite quickly, especially in full sun.
Does that sound right, Larry? Was it circumference you're talking about when you say 3 feet?
Yes, it does.
Okay, so that all makes sense then. That's great.
It does.
Well, thanks for your call. And we have a question here from Lucy, an email from Lucy. My question is, what is a good resource or book to buy to identify trees in Maine? And so, Patty, you know, beyond, obviously, we're talking about chestnuts, and so people would want to know which kind of chestnut they're seeing, but also other trees as well. What's a good reference for that?
Yeah, so I wanted to say, you know, the beginning of wisdom is to call things by their right names, right? So the Forest Trees of Maine put out by the Maine Forest Service is you can give us a call, we'll send it to you. Or again, on our website, it also can be found in bookstores. It's very cut to the chase identification, as opposed to maybe some of the Audubon books, which are great, but they go into a little more detail about the trees. So folks like our book because it's gives you the exact points right off about how to identify different trees. And it's a great thing to do especially on Arbor Day. That's a good thing to get out in the woods, get the kids out in the woods and get identifying trees.
Great. Well, we are taking another quick break right now. This is Maine Calling. We'll be right back. Welcome back. I'm Cindy Hahn, and you're listening to Maine Calling. The story of the demise of the American chestnut and how dedicated people are bringing it back and how those efforts are going in Maine. We're also talking about what can be done to protect Maine trees in general. On the show with me are Sarah Fitzsimmons with the American Chestnut Foundation, Patty Cormier, Maine State Forester, and Eva Butler with the Maine chapter of the American Chestnut Foundation. Join our conversation. Let us know your questions or comments about American chestnuts or other trees. Call 1-800-399-3566. Send a brief email to talk@mainepublic.org or post to our Facebook page or to Instagram. And we'll go now to Torbert calling from York. Hi, Torbert. Go ahead.
Good morning, Cindy and guest. About 10 years ago, I was exploring the interior of one of the Casco Bay peninsulas, which I don't know if I should name, but I came upon a grove of trees behind a wire fence with a sign on it. I went over and checked it out, and it said American Chestnut Experimental Grove. So I didn't know if you wanted that peninsula named or whatever.
Thanks, Torbert. Eva, is that a secret or is it okay to talk about that?
I guess my first question would be, is it on private land and is it legal to access it? If we don't know that, I'd be reluctant to put it out there.
Right,
but
beside the side of the road, and I think it seemed to be open and welcoming.
That's what those trees were planted for then. I think it's safe to say, you know, a lot of the work that the Maine chapter of the American Chestnut Foundation has done over the last 25 or more years now is to get chestnuts out where people can see them and enjoy them. And I know when I joined, the thing I really wanted to do was to be invited to go, okay, I'll tell you, I really wanted to put my arms around a chestnut tree. Uh-huh. You know, like, and as I've been the volunteer coordinator now for a couple of years, when I meet new members, I think they're also sheepish about what they really want. It was just, show me one, let me go see it in the wild. So that's one of the things that we're doing to get make opportunities for people to come out and see nuts. So when you point out that there's, I would say go ahead, Torbert, and describe where that is exactly, because it would be great for people to get out there and see it.
Yeah, go ahead, Patty.
Yeah, so the University of New England does have a patch of trees that they're researching in the Catskill Bay. So I don't know if it's that.
Okay, well, we have an email from Carl about whether the surviving mature American chestnuts in Maine are publicly accessible. So if someone did want to go hug one and you wanted to tell them where to go, where would they go?
Well, let's see. I think in general, what we've decided the best approach is, because many of these trees are on private land, is to, you know, join the Chestnut Foundation, get in touch with us through our website, and, you know, we'll get you in, we'll let you know where you can go see something without trespassing. And we really want to be very cognizant of the fact that people are generous sometimes with their information about where trees are. They want their trees to be incorporated into this research. They also probably don't want hundreds of people tramping through their place without permission. One of the really exciting things that the Maine chapter is doing now is we've just initiated a project called Chestnuts Across Maine. And we've got about 10 pilot projects set up for this spring. But the goal of this initiative is to get small groups of chestnuts in land trusts and public lands across Maine over the next several years, partly to put the trees out there to see, you know, just get them out there so people can see them. But also, I mean, I know personally that one of the roles that chestnuts has played for me when I, you know, retired and came back to live in Maine permanently is I just didn't know many people. And I feel like the people that I've met through the Chestnut Foundation have been, you know, just my people. They're people that are engaged in the world. They want to do good. They're very kind, loving sorts of people. And I sort of credit the chestnut in a way for that. Is the chestnut is bringing us together around the love of a tree. And in the world that we live in now, it's the what we really need to be focusing in on, as I think, is how much people crave connection. And this tree, you might think you're doing the job for the benefit of the tree, but I really believe that this tree is giving back to us by bringing us together with a mission and goodwill and letting us recognize in each other how much goodness there is in the world. Sometimes you need a tree to do that.
Patty.
And I just wanted to add to that along with getting involved with the Chestnut Foundation, there's many communities have conservation commissions. And so that's another route of getting involved. And then you would, it's an avenue to hearing more about these chestnut trees and other trees as well in your community.
Calling in is JC from Freedom. Hi, JC. What did you want to talk about?
Thanks for taking my call. Happy Arbor Day. Working on a structure here in Freedom, actually, that has 47-foot chestnut plates and 34-foot chestnut tie beams. Looking pretty good after over 200 years.
Wow.
I've been planting chestnuts from a local stand here for the last 15 years. And I was part of the Connecticut American Chestnut Foundation planting a bunch of orchards years ago, but I've extracted myself from anything having to do with hybridization. And I just want to make two quick comments, important points, I think, to keep in mind in this process of restoring our beloved tree. One being, of course, it was so dominant in the forest. And it was very dominant before Europeans came around, but late, sediment, pollen records show us that only really through European intervention did it become as prevalent as it was, sometimes coppicing quickly. We heard how quick they grow, and they just coppiced into sometimes pure stands in the south. And, you know, kind of set up arguably a perfect kind of storm situation for the blight. The second comment I'd like to make is that the blight didn't kill every tree either. I did a number of read through all kinds of old newspaper articles years ago. And yes, turns out, as I'm sure you well know, that we cut down many, many of those trees. ahead of the blight, as a matter of fact. But coming out of that, those two comments, it's critical, I think, to keep the native stands that we have free of that hybrid pollen, even if just for the sake of having the availability of the pure genetics. There's also hypovirulence. I'm not sure if it was mentioned, but a little tidbit for anybody who does want to plant these trees, preferably 100% American, giving them eastern, you know, exposure or northern exposure. The blight really gets into a sun-blistered young bark. You know, the older, mature trees are much more resistant, except for up in the branches. The animals can be vectors to bring, you know, the blight up there.
Okay. Well, JC, I'm going to give Sarah a chance to comment since we're getting close to the end of the show. Thanks so much for sharing all of your work. Sarah, go ahead.
Yeah, I think, you know, it's important to recognize that it is important from a native species perspective to really incorporate all of those genetics as much as possible. So, you know, Eva and the main chapter going out and finding wild type Americans and restoring them, conserving those genetics is absolutely vital. I think it's important to recognize, too, that hybridization in and of itself is not bad, or incorporating genetics from other locations isn't in and of itself bad, or diluting those wild type genetics. So I think it's important to recognize that sometimes you have to incorporate other things in order to save, you know, the overall ecosystem function. With regards to hypervirulence, it is a tool that can be used. What we've found through extensive research on that tool. So hypervirulence is what happens when the fungal blight gets infected by a virus. So everything gets infected by something, right? I mean, Robert Frost write a poem? Evil Tendencies Cancel, I think, is what it was called. So the fungus gets infected by a virus. But this is only effective when the tree has some resistance in and of itself. So if you have a tree that is completely susceptible and doesn't have resistance, hypervirulence isn't effective. So another tool in the toolbox to be added to hybridization work, breeding work, and biotech tools. But, you know, unfortunately, none of these tools alone will be what can restore the American chestnut. It's really a matter of combining all of these tools like IPM or integrated pest management. That's a very commonly integrated technique across all plant and crops. And I think it holds true for the American chestnut as well.
Okay, great. Thanks. Patty, go ahead.
Yeah, I just wanted to add to a comment the caller made about, you know, saving natural genetic species, and that back in the day with chestnut, that folks were encouraging people to liquidate their chestnut, right? Get rid of it. It's coming. And we're facing that in the same way with ash, and the problem with that is we are seeing genetic resistance in some of our ash trees. So it's important that we not press the panic button and we learn from what happened before, and that we learn to recognize that there is genetic resistance and to encourage that. And okay, also, yeah. I wanted to say the caller was from Freedom, and I remember being out in the woods. I was called out in the woods by a landowner cutting trees, and there were the spiky husk on the ground, and he didn't know what they were. And it turned out he had been cutting some of the chestnut. And so that was a good save of some of the chestnuts in Freedom.
Oh, interesting. Yeah. I know we're going to have you back on, Patty, to talk more about some of the other threats facing some of our other trees, because we're almost out of time. I wanted to squeeze in a question, an email from Kiyoshi. A friend of mine is a chestnut farmer in Japan. She told me the trees in Japan are dying too. She didn't tell me why they're dying though, and I'm wondering if similar things are happening in other parts of the world. Sarah?
Yeah, I mean, there are a couple of major pathogens, so chestnut blight being one of them, and Japanese chestnut can be susceptible, but usually is typically resistant to it. Phytophthora root rot, though, that Phytophthora cinnamomi, that's a very damaging pathogen. Japanese chestnut often is resistant, but, you know, often when you have stands of trees that are generally genetically similar, singular pathogen can come through and wipe them out. I mean, we've talked about, I'm sure your listeners have heard about monocultures and the danger of that. So that may be what's going on. That's, I'd say those two major pathogens typically are issues in chestnut crops worldwide.
Okay, great. Lots of other questions coming, but I'm afraid we're out of time. So thank you all for joining us today. Eva Butler is an ecologist, community organizer, and outreach coordinator for the Maine chapter of the American Chestnut Foundation. Sarah Fern Fitzsimmons is a forest ecologist, and she's the chief conservation officer with the American Chestnut Foundation at Penn State. And Patty Cormier is director of the Maine Forest Service with the Department of Agriculture, Conservation, and Forestry. Today's sound engineer was Sam Tracy. Our theme song was composed by Mike Jandreau. You can find our past shows and sign up for Maine Calling's newsletter by going to mainecalling.org. And if you sign up for the newsletter, you'll be entered into a weekly drawing to win a mystery book bundle. Also, you can send a voice message to Maine Calling through the Maine Public Vox Pop app. It's a new and simple way to let us know your thoughts about upcoming shows or topics that you'd like us to cover. So check out that Maine Public Vox Pop app. I'm Cindy Hahn, and you've been listening to Maine Calling on Maine Public Radio.